The Reverend Johnson Mackay. This is BBC Radio 4 FM, where now it's time for our Book of the Week. Doubling Back is the author Linda Cracknell's account of walking in the footsteps of others. In today's final episode, Walking Home, Linda sets out on two different walks in her adopted Scotland. The reader is Teresa Gallagher.
St Cuthbert's Way. Up we went, luxuriating our boots and trouser legs in the deep pink skitey mud. Up and out of Melrose, in time for the shock of shower and the northern summit of the Eildon Hills. The landscape spread itself like a map. To the east was the first chapter of the five-day walk that Phil and I had planned, between the Roxburghshire Plains and the turn-screeched islands of the east. The Cheviots rose between the two, blocking our view to the coast. For Phil, walking through the borderlands to the Northumberland coast represented a walk home. A native of Newcastle, as a teenager he'd learned to dive around the Farne Islands, and later bought a boat and chugged it north around the coast to Oban, where he became a professional diver. Now in his late 40s, he had a longing to be back on those windswept eastern coasts. Phil and I had met only 10 months before, and this was our first long walk together. We were still adjusting to each other's pace, learning each other's territory. Whereas my approach to life often seems shaped by the need for activity and achievement, Phil is an expert at being. He's content in an armchair or warm hilltop with a book, or just savouring his own thoughts as long as a cup of tea is to hand. Beyond his slightly piratical non-conformity and the scent of the sea that came with him, it was his calm which attracted me to him, an antidote to my own rush. On this hilltop, made something of by both Bronze Age and Roman peoples, I took out a guidebook and read a story to Phil. It was here, according to a border ballad, that 13th-century poet Thomas the Rhymer kissed and was led away by the Fairy Queen. Three ways presented themselves: a narrow, thorny way of righteousness, a broad way of wickedness, and a winding way, the third, down a ferny brae. This takes Thomas on an extraordinary journey through the murk, murk night into Elfland, into a fertile garden beneath these hills. There the Queen offered him a red apple.
"They do that, don't they?" Phil said.
"Who?"
"Women in myths, offering apples all over the place, getting men into trouble."
The Fairy Queen promised the apple would give Thomas a tongue that can never lie. He tried to resist this gift, but she kept him there for 7 years, then released him back to the mortal world to become True Thomas, famous for his prophecies. A grey curtain sliced wind and hail between us and the Cheviots. "Shouldn't we be getting on?" I said. My hands were cold and I was looking at my watch.
"What's the rush?" said Phil, getting out his camera.
The next day we climbed to the border into England at Eccles Cairn, and the Eildons showed themselves behind us for the last time. Northumbrian names took flight from the map as we neared them, enjoyable to say aloud.
"Coldburn Hill," I said.
"Sticky Bog," Phil replied.
"Hedgehope Hill."
"Foulburn Gare."
"Skirl Naked," I snarled in conclusion.
Kissing Gates disappeared for a day, and we walked in near silence, each taking our own inner way, yards apart. Yavering Bell, the Goat Hill and Hill Fort, passed to our left, with its high necklace of rock ramparts. Humbleton Hill brought Harry Hotspur's name, in his decisive battle there against the Scots, to our lips. The first glimpse of the sea stopped us to gaze. Then down we went into Wooler, where Theakston's beer was on tap by a cosy fireside. In the early afternoon of the next day, the path brought us along a processional aisle of Scots pine to an overhanging rock, St Cuthbert's Cave. Crosses fashioned from sticks and grass had been left here, names carved into soft rock over several centuries. We sat in the sunshine and made tea, enjoying moments of peace and warmth. Cuthbert was torn between his duty as Bishop of Lindisfarne and the hermit's life, between island and high hilltop. He chose to walk everywhere in the spirit of democracy, talking to everyone he met. Bede tells how Cuthbert often took long journeys without carrying food, entrusting himself to God, the land, or to fasting. We intended to take the 11th century pilgrim's route to Lindisfarne across the mudflats. St. Cuthbert came the same way on his first journey here, choosing foot rather than horseback, in order to give himself time for prayer and reflection. Tourist literature cautions newcomers to seek local knowledge. Never attempt this route at dusk or on a rising tide. We were attempting it on the verge of both. As we left true land behind, we started to cross a wilderness of horizontals, buff and slime green beneath our feet, a lilac sky above. A journey of over an hour following a line of barnacle-crusted vertical posts, doubled in height by their reflection on wet sand. Our own reflections had us walking on water. A moan rose in the gloom ahead of us, then a wail and a whimper, as the small dark outline of St. Cuthbert's Isle emerged to our right. The voices grew louder and more numerous, until it seemed that a mournful seal song was guiding us in, or perhaps a siren song was luring us out, towards the rushing tongue of tide that forced us to detour from the marked way. Distant looking in the dusk, the southerly end of the land had started to prickle with artificial light, but we didn't fully realise how night had taken charge until we were winding amongst lit windows through the empty stone streets of the village towards our final stop, the Crown and Anchor. It was as if we'd reached the still centre of a labyrinth, circled a spiral staircase within a seashell. We'd fallen into step. The romance of place was now shared. "I never want to get in my car again," Phil said, and we tried to imagine a year of walking everywhere we wanted to go. It brought about a diminishing of horizons, a clarifying of priorities. The Birks of Aberfeldy, Perthshire, Scotland. The burn cackles, calling walkers to follow it upstream. And as usual, I submit to the deep embrace of the wooded gorge. This is the Birks of Aberfeldy, where trees brim from a cleft in the hillside, and a burn plummets down its centre from the falls of Moness. It's a chink of Arcadia, fashioned from water, woodland and rock, made famous by Rabbi Byrne's song that's preserved it as a pleasure walk for over 200 years. One of the signs erected in the car park shows him looking rather elegant, rather stuffed shirt for one born in a snowdrift and said to enjoy a roll in the heather. I've walked the Birks often, in many seasons and weathers, even at night. Returning home after a period away, this walk's one of the first things I'll do. I relearn the land with my repeated steps, my circuits. But it's not static. Things happen. Each time there's the possibility of new discoveries. Birks, the Scots word for birches, seems inaccurate at the beginning of the walk, because I reach the bridge through a grand hall of beech. When I reach the centre of the bridge, something breaks my foot rhythm. Incongruous against the russet foliage, two white roses have been left on the handrail. Wrapped in white ribbon, they're not fastened to the rail. At any moment they might be tossed by a breeze into the hands of white water bridesmaids below. I recall something I was told a night or two ago. Since I've lived here, I've known of two men who've fallen, slipped into the gorge. Both were rescued. Even a dog abandoned with a broken leg was carried out a day later. But this man was determined, lost amidst the Bernsian braes on everyone's favourite walk. Perhaps it was his own favourite once. His body was found hanging from a tree by a jogger one recent morning. A failed marriage, the rumour.
A path of deep leaves leads me away from the bridge and the strangeness of the roses. I'm a child again, shuffling my feet and flicking and scuffing. Airy play that reveals a dark underlayer of last autumn's crumbling mould. In a copper-floored clearing, there's another surprise for my walk today. A pale timber bench that I've never seen before. A dull brown figure sits on it with his back to me. Our national poet. Or perhaps I shouldn't say our. As an incomer, a white settler, his language isn't quite mine, even though I love Scots words like bahoochie, the part of the body that he's sitting on, and gloaming, wabbit, screeve, stravaig. Once the words are tasted on the tongue, I suppose they become my own. The poet is very absorbed, writing in his small notebook, face turned up towards the dancing light. A plaque on a rock further up the gorge already shows where he sat in 1787 to compose his song, or perhaps, as some would say, to adapt one he'd collected from Abergeldy. I get closer to the statue. Fake verdigris lines the bronze creases of his clothes and the wrinkles of skin on his fingers. In the fold of each elbow, a small pool of rainwater has collected, and in each floats a leaf. They're beech, not birch. I finally meet the birches, a host of them on the rising ground to my left, straight, slim and tall. They are silent and swaying slightly. Their foliage is all filigree and lace after the sturdiness of the beeches. This is the rich green heart of the birks. A torrent forges in from the main waterfall above, but the deepness of the gully here breaks the flow. A skim of white froth circles languidly on the black surface, betraying no bottom. Looking 200 feet up, I appreciate how darkly I'm enfolded. Up there is sun-topped foliage, breezy lightness. My climb to it begins now on wooden steps and bridges. With the opening of the views to the surrounding hills, I sense my memory markers scattering the valley sides, linked by a web of paths. A picnic spot. A confession made over there, an illicit kiss here. My neighbours have been a kind of yardstick to my years in this valley. The 6-year-old now away in a hydroelectric engineering job. The white collie who arrived as an irrepressible puppy, now taking every chance to lie down. My eyes reach for the far horizon, rest on the slopes where late afternoon sun toasts the bracken, setting off the white hilltops behind. Perhaps next autumn when I cross the bridge, the date will be marked with some different flowers in an autumn colour. By then, the recollection of a stranger's death will have softened into my expectations of the walk, in the same way that I'll nod to the statue of Burns each time I pass, accepting him as a friendly landmark. But now I look down on a field of grey slate roofs, amongst which slopes my own. Contained within this walk each time I do it is the forever pleasure of turning for home. At this point, I always start to think ahead to putting on the kettle and making tea. Tomorrow, perhaps, I'll take a turn of the story once again.
Teresa Gallagher was reading the final episode of Doubling Back by Linda Cracknell. The book was abridged by Sian Preece and produced by Gaynor McFarlane. After the news, Woman's Hour will be remembering the first American woman to run for president in 1872. That's in a couple of minutes.
Over on BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Churchill had never denied the eventual need for a major campaign in Europe.
Is there going to be an invasion soon? Everyone says there is.
His doubts concern not whether to invade, but when and how.
Avranches, Domfront.
Invasion. Tonight.
Yes.
Here.
Here. Normandy.
Ahead of the 70th anniversary of the D-Day landings, BBC Radio 4 Extra focuses on the lead-up to the historic events. Throughout this Thursday, starting at 12:30 in the afternoon.